It's my pleasure to introduce Jennifer Shelby of Signature Leadership to talk to you about exactly that, leadership. Jennifer, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. Make sure we get our technology working. Everybody can hear me all right? Okay. So I want to thank everybody for allowing me to speak with you today. This is a wonderful audience for me. I actually was with Apple for 88 to 93 and spent the majority of that working in the higher ed market and education market. So to some degree, this is a bit of an old home week for me. So I'm really looking forward to speaking with you all today. Before we get started, just a couple questions so I can kind of get a sense for who you are, who all of you are out there. Just a show of hands, how many of you actually are in education or the university market? Okay, fair enough. You're close. You said about 40%. It was IT. And then how many of you have IT type of positions or technical positions? Okay, excellent. And then how many of you are on more of the corporate side, either small businesses or work for maybe some of the larger corporations out there? Okay, great. So that's a really good kind of 50-50 mix. That's terrific. So what we're going to do is we're going to spend about 40 minutes or so talking about leadership. And what I'd like to be able to do is if you've got some questions or some comments along the way, let's definitely try to make some time to talk about them. And I also have prepared a few handouts for you all. So if after this you'd like to explore your own leadership initiatives and abilities, we've got some things for you. I printed out a few here, but we're also going to put them up on the website, and you are free to download those at any time and send me emails if you have questions or you want to do some follow-up or whatever. So at this point, I think we'll just go ahead and get started, and we'll kind of see what goes on with the questions that you all have. So I'm not sure what's happening. So we'll just kind of get started, and we'll just jump in. I'm not a big person on PowerPoint slides anyway. So when we were thinking about putting this together, I'd spoken to CZ and a couple other folks about the types of things that might be interesting for you all. And the art of leadership is what we decided to create here today. And it's interesting because if you look in the business section of any bookstore or you're on Amazon.com, the number of leadership books is absolutely extraordinary. So you would think after all of this time, we would absolutely understand what the heck it is and how we're supposed to all, be it and do it. And at the same time, you could talk about it for forever. And so what I decided to do is try to pick maybe three things that you haven't really thought about or maybe haven't heard much about. And so what we're going to do is kind of break this into three areas. So when we think of leadership, it's a fairly, nondescript term, and yet we all seem to know it when we see it, right? Would you say that you kind of know it when you see it? And yet if somebody said define leadership, if anybody out there in the audience has a perfect definition, I would love to hear it. But it's an elusive term, but yet it really isn't. So what we're going to do is we're going to focus on three components of what I think leadership is. And when I work with executives and other companies out there, these are some of the things that that tend to surface for me and give me some perspective as I get better at my own leadership skills. And the first one is your relationships. So we're going to spend a fair amount of time talking about your relationships and how that impacts your ability to lead. The second one is belief systems. And then the third one is your style. And so what we'll do is we'll kind of weave all three of these together and see what we come up with in the end. So out of everybody in this room, how many of you would say that you demonstrate strong leadership skills? How many of you would say that? Okay, good. Hopefully, by the end, more of your hands will be raised because I think everybody needs to realize that we are all leaders. And part of the reason why I created Signature Leadership is because I do believe that everybody is a leader, whether they necessarily know it or not, whether it's in your lives, your community, your work. And so part of my goal is, as I'm out there working with executives and other managers and so forth, is to help you all realize that you actually bring to whatever you're doing, whether it's running a user group or your day job, as we call it, you actually demonstrate and bring a lot of those skills forward. I want to read you something really quick because I think it sets the stage for a lot of what we're all trying to talk about here. This is a book, it's about 7 or 8 years old now. Most of the leadership books that I have been looking at the last couple of years are not the things that are coming out recently. It's more the topics that have been covered about 5 to 10 years ago. And I'm finding that these types of books are really terrific if you really want to explore this, because the things that they talk about really seem to hold true. This is a book called Maximum Leadership, and it's written by two gentlemen, Charles Farkas and Philippe DeBacker. And what they did in 1996 is they went around the world and looked at multinational corporations and tried to identify what the key attributes that made certain companies more successful than others, what made more CEOs more successful than others, what prolonged their ability to stay at the top, that sort of thing. And it was very interesting because they took a global view, and I think today, looking at any kind of leadership program within corporations, you have to have that global perspective in play. So that's one of the reasons why I like this book so much. But there's a very interesting gentleman. He has a difficult name to pronounce, so you're going to have to pardon me here. His name is Ventnor van Vlissingen. And he's the CEO, he was the CEO at the time of a company called SHV Holdings, and they're a huge multinational overseas. And one of his styles, if you will, is he's a big proponent of human assets, and we're going to talk about this if we ever get our slideshow up and running. But he has a couple of very profound things to say. He became the CEO of this company in 1984. Today he's the chairman of the board and is handing the reins over to some other people in his company. But I think he captures, again, a lot of the things that we've already heard a lot. But he's very distinct about this. And he's talking about, to him, the most important attribute in a company is your human assets or your employees, which is a philosophy that I subscribe to quite heavily, so I'm kind of drawn to him. But he became CEO in 1984. And what he saw in 1984 is that there was a whole new generation of managers who were coming into the workforce. And they were obviously very different than previous managers that kind of came from, obviously, the World War II generation. And so what he saw here is that they were much better educated, they were more idealistic, and less corporate-minded. And I think to a large degree, those three things are holding today. I think it's even gotten more so. And so his perspective, and this is his quote, "And to give those people a better chance, you had to build an organization where they could have much more responsibility because we didn't believe we could get anybody to do their best unless you could really make them responsible." And I think a lot of what we are all wanting in any job, and part of what I think makes us all Apple enthusiasts, is that the Macintosh-Apple revolution, if you will, was about doing things better, finding a better way, becoming better at what we do, and wanting to work with people that make a difference. So there's this great kind of common theme. So what he basically did in a company that has about 40,000 employees was start very slowly over the course of 20 years instituting this philosophy throughout all of his corporations that it was about how do we get each person to take more and more responsibility for what they do. He also had to do a lot of work on getting the company to change. So he's one of these folks that believes that if you need to make a change, you need to do it quickly. If you want to have change, it's you, the chief executive, who has to be seen to do it himself. You have to expose yourself. I think it's the only reason you get paid very well. Though don't we wish we had more CEOs that felt that way today? It's very important all the time to tell people to do it themselves. We have very talented people. You don't have to stimulate an athlete who is running 1,000 meters. You don't have to tell them that they have to win. They already know that. But you can ask them, hey, have you checked your diet? Have you got the best trainer? That you can do, because I don't believe telling people too much, because the younger generation are the ones who really make the money now. You ask them the questions, but they need to find out the answers themselves. So this is an example of a leader who not only transformed a corporation from being very much looking inward to, okay, what are we supposed to do today, to getting them all to look outward, but to take responsibility for what that is they were doing. And what they did was they created a whole group of people that drove the company forward. And it's a really, really interesting corporation, and he was pretty much a maverick, I think. So he's an example of somebody who uses his own belief systems and talks to other people about becoming more comfortable in their own belief systems so that they can move that forward. And that's something that we're going to talk about quite a bit today. So there's an organization that I've begun doing some work with. They're called Woodstone Consulting, and they're in the mountains of Colorado. And the founder of this company is a former PepsiCo executive during the days when John Sculley was still there. And his job was to go out and get the best talent possible so they could take on Coke head-to-head. And this gentleman has been doing his own research for about 20 years now. And what he found is that in recruiting top talent around the country and looking at different organizational structures, this is kind of a compilation of about 20 years of data that he has recently put together. 68% of all new businesses fail. 80% of mergers and acquisitions fail, which is really scary because there's a lot of that going on. And the most interesting one to me is that 40% of executives who change jobs fail. So in the world of recruiting, they're going after the brightest and the best, and yet they still have a lot of trouble once they get into these organizations. The big question to me is, why does that happen? And I think a lot of the reasons why this happens is because the executives don't take the time to manage their relationships with their peers, so, you know, cross-departmentals. They don't take the time to manage up very well, and they don't get the time, they don't take the time to get to know their employees. So when you look at why is leadership important, one of the biggest things you can point to just from career development is that 40% of the time, executives who change jobs really struggle and have a hard time. So part of what we try to do is get them to understand what it is that's going to set them up for success. And one of the biggest things here is relationships. And so when you go into something new, it's like we're all, you know, here for the user group, but this applies to kind of the informal leadership that you're providing to the members of your user group, but also provides a really strong context to what you're doing outside of the user group, which is to change what you believe about a way to do something, you can become much more effective. And we're going to talk about belief systems here because it's a real key. So one of the things to really talk about here about, okay, so what does make a strong leader? What does make a strong leader, and again, this is the same data points coming from Ed Marr at Woodstone, is that over and over again when people are surveyed, strong leaders do these four major things. They add value. So if you are in an organization or you are currently in a position where you absolutely do not feel that you are adding value, that's kind of a flag of something that you might want to take a look at and say, okay, how can I be sure I'm adding the most value? If you're in a company where you're growing and you're actually trying to develop what you want your company culture to look like, probably a really key point here to think about is what's the best way to add value? Strong leaders raise the standards. If you think about when Steve Jobs came back to Apple a few years ago, probably every one of these items here rings very true for him. So the first time he came to Apple, my guess is he probably added a lot of value. He maybe raised standards, but didn't necessarily do it in a way that allowed other people to step up to it, right? He certainly was the creator of his relationships. That wasn't necessarily always, you know, the right kind of relationships. But being the creators of your relationships is a really key thing here. And this last thing, this kind of deals more with kind of the company politics, the gossiping, and all that kind of stuff that just, you know, exists in almost every company. If there's one wish that I could make, it would be to get people to understand the power of being loyalists versus saboteurs. And the part here about being a loyalist, and again, if you look at companies that are succeeding right now, their management teams and their executives firmly put themselves in the camp of they're a loyalist. I like to use a lot of football analogies because I'm kind of a football nut, but if you look at Bill Parcells, sorry if you're not Dallas fans, I'm not a Dallas fan, but I'm a Bill Parcells fan. He is an absolute loyalist. Everybody said it wouldn't work with Jerry Jones, all these sorts of things, but he's done something that no other coach has ever done. He's taken a team that was 5-11 3 years in a row and absolutely flipped it this year and was 11-5 in 1 year with almost all the same players. He is absolutely a loyalist to what the Dallas Cowboys stand for, and he will not let anything or anyone get in his way of that. He may have a very tough style that isn't necessarily the style that you and I would want to take, but he's a loyalist, so he doesn't allow dissension. So if you think about kind of what's going on in a lot of pro sports these days, there's a lot of turf wars going on between player and coach. And so what starts to happen is even if you're being a benign saboteur, you're still being a saboteur. So one of the things that I do when I work with companies is I get them to absolutely embrace this concept of being a loyalist. So if there's a problem in production or there's a problem in manufacturing, there is no finger pointing that goes on. You, as you know, the head of that department, owe it to the other head of that department to say, well, what can we do to help you? So think about if there's just one thing that you took away today back to your organizations and back to the user groups, is how can you institute this culture of being a loyalist? Every single thing that happens in a company impacts you, whether it's your job or not your job. So if you're the creator of your relationship, you don't sabotage somebody else in another department because they didn't do their job or because they were rude to you last week or haven't ever shown you much courtesy, doesn't mean it's okay to do that. So true leaders are loyalists, they're the creators of their relationships, they raise standards, and they absolutely add value, and they, by living that standard, they become that. So my point here is that leadership is both an art and a science of cultivating relationships that cause people to follow. So if we think about strong leaders, I was trying to come up with some that were outside the computer industry that might be more interesting to look at since we all tend to focus a lot on that. Bill Parcells kind of comes to mind because he does create this wave, right? You're either on his team or off his team. The train left the station and you either get on or you get off. But he's very clear about that. There's some other people out there like Lou Gerstner of IBM. He did an amazing thing. He took a company that didn't feel very good about themselves and has elevated themselves. Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines, same kind of thing. You know, it's a little bit crazy at the airport, and Southwest isn't perfect, but you know what? Their employees are pretty happy for the most part. They're pretty nice. Year in and year out, they always score really high in public satisfaction. So there's some really great things that are happening there. So when we talk more about the art versus the science, and again, it kind of goes to, you know, what's inside, right? So I said earlier that we were going to focus on effective relationships, your belief systems, and then kind of this style. And so the thought here is that there's always an overlap in everything that you're doing. And when you're creating effective relationships, it definitely is going to impact your belief systems. But you have to have a core set of values and beliefs to bring to the table. So part of what is required of leaders is to actually put themselves out there. And that's what that gentleman was saying when I was reading that intro to you, is that he was willing to put himself out there. He was willing to expose himself a little bit so that people could see who he was. And what happens in those cases is when you're willing to put yourself out there a little bit, it opens people up a little bit and it makes them see you as a person, not as a title. All right? Another really key thing that happens, and again, this is something that we can all kind of think about, is what is your style? And a lot of our style is very dependent upon what kinds of experiences and influences we've had along the way. When I first worked for Apple in 88, it was, you know, go, crazy time. And Apple did a fabulous job of recruiting managers from Kodak and all of these other great industries. And so Apple had a core management team that was, you know, second to none. And I was incredibly lucky as a, you know, young 20, you know, post, you know, graduate to work for such phenomenal people that really taught me the ropes. So I was able to emulate and learn a certain management style from a lot of great people that I, you know, had the fortune of working for. So I was very influenced by that, and my experience was very positive. So my style tends to be much more falling out from those early experiences more than anything else. So think about what your beliefs are, what you think you need to do to have effective relationships with the people that you work with, and then we're going to explore this style thing a little bit. The other thing that you may be looking at this thinking, well, belief systems, yeah, okay, how do we really make that work for us? So a couple of examples that have hit me really strong the last year or so. Susie actually knows this because I wrote about it. But Annika Sorenstam took a lot of heat when she played in the men's tournament this summer. And it's interesting because I took a very different view. She's already at the top of her game. All the women, you know, golfers were like, okay, here she goes again. But the most amazing thing happened. After she finished that tournament, she went on to have the most amazing, you know, rest of the summer with her golf tournaments. She did not, from my perspective anyway, go into that golf tournament for an ego thing. What she did was she said, all right, I am already the best woman golfer, but you know what? I want to be better. So she had this belief system that the only way to get better is to put herself into a situation that was the rest of us would be an absolute no-win, one of the most frightening things on the planet to do. But she had this belief system that she was going to get through it and that she was going to learn something valuable from it. And indeed, she did. You know, she was able to do it with grace. She didn't break down. She had some pretty good shots. She had people rooting for her for the most part. And she came away a better golfer because she had a belief that she could take her game to another level. And what started happening with the other women golfers is there were also three or four extraordinary championships in women's golf the rest of the summer where she didn't win, but other women won. And I would venture to guess that because she's such a great role model for them, even though it's probably, you know, they love to hate her kind of thing because she's always winning, but she, again, she raised her standards, and guess what? So did the other women golfers. So there was a lot of other women that won tournaments this year, and I absolutely believe that she gave them that oomph to do it because her belief system was so strong, and then theirs in turn followed. So there's a great example of somebody's belief systems, how contagious that can be. So think about your own belief systems and if there's a way for you to help kind of raise your standards, raise your game, and then see what happens for the people around you. Another great example of belief systems, does anybody remember in the last couple of months about that young teenager in Hawaii who she lost her arm to a shark attack? Have you guys seen that she's surfing? You know, she's been on the news station. She was on CNN over Christmas. You know, she doesn't really get what the big deal is. You know, so she lost her arm. She's up there, you know, and it's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. She's absolutely has this belief system, right? Okay, so I lost my arm. I could still be a great surfer. Whereas the rest of us would be like, are you crazy? It's amazing. So when you think about the power of belief systems, you know, find something that really touches you as being a great, great story, and then pull from that what makes that amazing or what made that area jump forward. Those are two that I use quite a bit these days. Okay, here's another kind of interesting thing to look at. When we work with companies and I ask them why you think somebody is a good leader or a strong leader or what makes them perfect for their role, these are typically the things that I hear back from people. I do a lot of interviews where we go in and we do like a 360-degree kind of interview. So we'll interview somebody in the shipping and receiving department, and then everybody who touches that person, we go talk to them. So what we do is we can look at each department within a large company or even smaller companies and see where the synergies are, where the disconnects are. And one of the things that shows up time and time again is people will choose to follow somebody based on understanding these things. There's a vision I can share, which means the way I interpret things like this is there's a company direction or a company strategy, and they individually know how they fit into that. That's really key. So if you are a manager in a group or you're trying to do something, you know, within the Apple user group community, people have to be able to buy into that vision. So whatever your vision is, find a way to articulate it in a way that makes them feel part of it. Integrity and trust, obviously that kind of goes without saying, is willing to develop me and my skills, knows my values and aspirations. Okay, this is, again, that area of because you're willing to put yourself out there, people get to know you, and then therefore they're willing to share. So somebody who actually knows what makes me tick, challenges me, collaborates, affiliation with importance. This one's actually probably the most important one because, again, there's a lot of people, I think we all have examples of that where people just walk through, hi, how are you, you know, and you're like, all right, you know, or that person that you've been introduced to 10 times and they still act like it's the first time they've met you. Okay, we're not talking about that. We're actually talking about leaders and executives and managers that really know their people and that is sincere and it comes across. So a commitment from someone to follow a leader is very personal. And again, it's predicated on the belief that there's a benefit, either for themselves, their company. It's a shared vision type of thing. So when you look at this, ask yourself how many of you can say this about the organizations you're currently working for, or another way to look at it is if you're a manager or you work with a lot of other peers, how well does this fit your own company? Okay, so let's talk about leadership styles a little bit. Again, this is from this book here, Maximum Leadership. It's a great book if any of you are interested in it. They identify that there's five major styles that all leaders tend to have. Now, you're going to have mixes and matches of these, but I think it's really important to identify what your own style is. So if you're the creator of your relationships, you understand what your beliefs are, and you're very in tune to what your actual leadership style is, you can be much more empowering and the driver of your relationships. And you can become more of a conduit, if you will, for making this leadership kind of contagious. Because I absolutely believe that everybody in this room is already a leader. It's just uncovering some of those things internally that's going to make that rise up for you. So the strategic steward, that is more of somebody who believes that the vision and the strategy starts at the top and then gets pushed out. The one key thing about leadership styles that I wanted to say is the thing that also separates this book is that they believe, and all of these leaders believed, that executive management is at the center of a company and everything moves out from there. Versus that typical hierarchical where you've got the CEO and the org charts that go like this. These people that they interviewed actually don't do an org chart that way. What they do is they believe that corporate, if you will, sits in the center and that all the other functional groups and departments are really the ones outside there driving. So it's a little bit of a different perspective than what we normally see with all the org charts out there. But it gets people to start thinking that, you know, what is corporate's job? It's the center of the company, not the drivers of the company. So a strategic steward, does anybody have an example of somebody who might, out there, who might be a strategic type of leader? Can you say that again?
A football coach.
Exactly. A football coach tends to be this. This is probably our Bill Parcells kind of guy. Strategic type of companies tend to have the vision very much handled by the CEO, and then more of the tactics are pushed out. Strategic steward leaders and companies that follow this philosophy, they also tend to be, companies that have a very specific solution that they're providing, or they might be the industry leaders in what they do, okay? The human assets, which is, you know, obviously my personal favorite and the one I align to more, they tend to be, it's probably one of the toughest ways to be a leader because, again, you're trying to herd cats. You know, it's a really tough thing to do. Everybody's got such a different style, that's a different personality. But if you can harness and get people to really be in touch with themselves, then you get to know, okay, this is how you do your job, and Joe, this is how you do your job. It's less about what the job is, and it's more about getting to know, this person worked this way, so I'm going to set up a structure for them, and this is the goal, and I'm going to let them get there however they need to get there. So you've got to be very clear on what you want the outcome to be. I would say companies with really strong brands tend to be very human asset driven. They like to do a lot of cross-functional training. So like Procter & Gamble and these big consumer brands where people are there for 10, 20, 30 years and they move around to different divisions. They become very much human assets because they believe it takes a minimum of 5 to 10 years to really learn what's going on in an organization. So this is very people focused. Expert. These tend to be the huge conglomerates. The multinational corporations, and they actually believe it's kind of that silo effect, right? So I'm an expert in this area, I'm an expert in this area, and there's not a lot of cross-pollination that goes on. You don't see too much of this in Silicon Valley right now or in the high-tech space, but I think probably initially some of the telecom companies used to be this way, right? And they've had to push themselves out of that a bit. Now the box, this one's very interesting. How many of you are familiar with like Myers-Briggs and personality assessments, things like that? Have any of you ever interviewed companies that use those? Or anybody work for companies that use those? Not many, yeah. The box is very interesting because what this is it's a management style where they actually put together employees and a lot of processes and structures that are very similar. Right, so here's the rules, here's, literally it is the box. So, I can do anything I want on this stage. And I knowingly join a company knowing, okay, great, this is my box. I was going to ask you all if you're seeing any correlation there to government, because I think to a large degree, a manager that works in the federal government has to have this to a large degree. So these styles aren't necessarily good or bad, but I would say the federal government is a big one. Defense contractors tend to be very much this way. So the sciences, hard engineering, those types of companies, where human genetics, biotech, those tend to be companies and managers that are a little bit more in the box, if you will. And then this last one, which is one that I think everybody here is probably very familiar with, is the change agent, right? So very fast pace, change is nonstop. It takes a very specific type of leader to be able to employ this, because you're constantly changing and people don't like change. You like to come in and pretty much know every day what your job is. So if you look at these leadership styles, everybody in this room will probably identify with one more than any of the others. But depending on your situation, has a lot to do with which one will come out in you. So we all have, you know, all of these at some level, right? There's a certain way, I do things with my daughter, and when my husband doesn't do it that way, I'm putting him in a box, right? There's a right way and a wrong way sometimes. Or there's a process for which, you know, things flow. In a manufacturing or a supply chain, again, the box can be a very, very useful technique. But the key to this is understanding how you make all of this work, right? So if you're developing relationships with your key stakeholders, again, we're talking about what are your belief systems, right? So what beliefs do you bring about what you think of your customers, right? What relationship do you want to have with your customers? And then what kind of style are you showing them? Same thing goes through with your employers, your suppliers. Do you think your suppliers are partners? Are your suppliers fitting a need? You know, how do you view them? Because depending on the relationship you set up with each one of these stakeholders is exactly the result you're going to get. So if you have an antagonistic relationship with any of these areas, chances are you've had a whole lot to do with why that is. From the aspect of the relationship, your beliefs, and what your style is. So if you're in a situation where your suppliers are pretty tough to work with and you are worried, you got to keep tabs on them, again, you might want to bring a leadership style that's a little bit more of a box, because you need them to follow certain rules so that you know you can count on that, right? Your employees, you may want to be more of a change agent and let them drive it. If you're in a company where the salespeople are really close to the customer, you might want to, you know, go ahead and be more the human assets. So my point about this is you look at each constituent, evaluate what your relationship is, what do you want the relationship to be, what belief systems do you have about them, and then what leadership style do you think would be most appropriate for these situations. And if you take those three approaches and overlay it all the way over, I absolutely guarantee you that you can change anything that's not going the way you want it to go right now. So again, this is an area where you could just, you know, spend, you know, pick one or two that's really important to you. One of the areas, again, for managers that I do a lot with managers is get them to focus more on their peers. Most managers don't think much about their peers. They're so busy, you know, managing up or managing down that you forget your team, you know, your side team, if you will. So a great area to look is at your peers, your customers, your employees. If you just did those three, chances are you'd feel better, things would be working smoother, and you wouldn't have this resistance going on. So let's talk a little bit about what holds us back, because this is a biggie. I think people's biggest fear is rejection. Right? We all want to feel part of something. Part of why this user group is so special is because everybody's welcome, everybody feels good, everybody fits in. You go back into the world, and your biggest thing is, well, what if they don't like me? What if this doesn't work? Okay, I've been reorged. What if I don't like this group? What if my manager doesn't like me? I didn't even get to interview that manager. There's all these things that happen. So there's a lot of fear that happens. There's a lot of insecurity, uncertainty. And to some degree, depending on what kind of a company you're working with, you know, there's always that threat of, you know, somebody's going to take over, or we're going to get reorged, or I'm going to get a new boss. So the flip side of that, and again, I kind of use the Annika Sorenstam model here, is self-esteem, confidence, capability, and high performance. That's what we're shooting for, stuff on the right side. So do you think she was scared to go into that men's tournament? Yeah. Do you think she was feeling insecure? Uncertain? Yeah. And threat? Yeah, I'm sure she was feeling very threatened. Because again, not everybody thought this was a very good idea. But what came out for her, because she was willing to take that step, again, her belief system was such that she came out of that with self-esteem, confidence, capability, and guess what? She's at a higher performance level than she was before she started. So if there's something that isn't working for you, or there's a goal that you have for yourself this year, you know, we all have New Year's resolutions. My New Year's resolution is to create opportunity this year. And the only way I'm going to create opportunity is to have a belief system that, one, I am going to create opportunity. And I got to focus on being really strong on the right side of this slide. So if there's something that is particularly challenging to you or something that you want to change this year, ask yourself, okay, where's the fear coming from? Where's the insecurity? Where's the uncertainty? And is there a threat? Am I threatened? And then figure out what would need to happen to turn each one of those over into this side. And if you do that, it kind of gives you a starting action plan for moving forward. And again, every time you decide to change the game and kind of get out of the old patterns and step into new, I guarantee you, you're going to impact at least one other person. Because as soon as they see you going, you know what, I'm going to be a loyalist, if it's to myself, to my company, my department, whatever it is, you move forward, everybody's back here. So if they want to talk to you or keep up to you, they got to come up here. So just by raising your own standards, you will raise standards for anybody around you. You can do it with your family. You can do it with your kids. Try it in your communities, with your user groups. If you guys are butting heads on an issue over and over again, or there's something that you want to move on to, or a new thing that you want to take on, or with your jobs or your career. So think about this. It's a really interesting exercise. Highly recommend it. Okay, so let's talk about how to actually move some relationships forward. It's probably safe to say that everybody here has a relationship that you would like to improve, or a relationship that's strained. And so what I'm going to ask everybody to do, again, we're the creator of our relationships, right? We're the owner of our relationship, is to make the first commitment that, one, you're accountable for your behavior. So if you're working with somebody, either within your offices or a supplier, or even sometimes you have customers that you're just, you know, butting heads with, make the commitment that you're going to be accountable for your behavior moving forward, and that you're going to fix that relationship. It may not be the perfect relationship. It may not be everything you wanted it to be, but it can certainly be better. Now, this third thing about being capable of setting aside your personal agenda, this can be really hard to do. It's a really, really hard thing to do. So this is an area where sometimes I ask people to help me with. Right? So if you have a boss who is supportive of you, ask them to hold your agenda. So if your goal is, hey, I want to get a promotion in the next few months, ask your boss to hold that agenda for you so you can go work on the stuff you need to work on. Because if somebody can hold on to that for you, it kind of frees you up to then go do this thing. And have a personal stake in this. So if you become accountable for the success of your relationship, you put your agenda aside, you can fix that relationship, it's just going to propel you forward. And again, this becomes contagious, and all the people around you start wanting to do the same thing, or they start noticing that something's different. Did you have a comment? Sure. Yeah. One example I use is if you're doing some career development with your boss, or let's say you have a special project, and the outcome of that project is that you want to, you're hoping that that gives you a raise or promotes you into greater responsibility. The problem with that, as it relates to this agenda, is that's always in the back of your mind, right? Will this action get me that? And you got to take that out of it, because the action should be enough. So if you want to fix a relationship with some or you know have a strained relationship, you want to fix that relationship because you just want to fix the relationship. But when you have an outcome in mind or a result that you'd like to have from that, it can get in the way. Now there's another agenda at work, and it will cloud your thinking. Right? So if you have a good relationship with your manager, just say, hey, you know what? One of my outcomes of this is I'd really like to be considered for X. Or if I'm able to do these three things, you know, can I then move forward and get this raise or get this promotion, or would you support me in this? And if you can get them to say, yeah, I absolutely will, then they're now holding that for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
I was going to say, I think what kind of stopped me when I saw that is, unfortunately, the word agenda is becoming a nasty word.
That could be very true, yes.
Agenda, when I first read that, I thought you meant that when you hear someone say, oh, so-and-so has an agenda, we don't think of that necessarily as a goal list anymore.
Okay.
Because they have surreptitious...
Right. Okay.
Holding my agenda, it's like, no, my agenda is mine.
Okay. That's a really great point. It might absolutely be the word. So if that word is making everybody a little... Yeah, so it's personal goal. So let's rephrase that. Let's say be willing and capable of setting aside your personal goal, the outcome that you're looking for, the end result. It's more of that, again, your belief system is, I do these things, the outcome will take care of itself. So taking out the word personal agenda... in this case, probably doesn't work. I usually use this for corporations because, again, a lot of executives absolutely do have personal agendas. And you have to kind of tell them that, hey, I know you have a personal agenda and you need to drop it. So, yeah, that's absolutely fair.
Power authority, the word agenda is an
Yeah, so we'll replace agenda. So you no longer see agenda, you see results, outcome, goals. Absolutely, that's a fair point. The net is this, is that you become accountable for the success in the relationship. So everything you're doing is about succeeding and moving forward, not looking back, not saying, well, if that guy hadn't done that, it's all about moving forward and being responsible for your relationships. That is the only thing that's going to move you forward. Yes?
So making the relationship better in and of itself has great value.
Huge value.
And the benefit of that is that good benefits come from that, and you don't have to even be the motivator of that part of it. It just naturally flows out of it.
Beautiful. That's awesome. That's very well said. Yeah, I mean, we all think about we have, some strained relationship somewhere in our lives, right?
Yeah.
How draining is that?
Yeah.
Right? It just zaps your energy when you have to deal with ick. Right, and again, I think we all share a general passion for what we do, and the passion is what gives you the energy, and that's what keeps you moving forward, and that's what, again, it makes you very attractive. It makes people want to be with you. Again, it makes people want to follow because they believe that you have some great intrinsic benefit to them. When you get dragged down by the yuck, you know, let's face it, we're all not always our best. We all have off days. We all have bad days. Somebody always is pushing a button, and that stuff can be very draining. So. You know, the end here is, all right, pick one relationship and fix it. In the back, you had a question.
Oh, very good. Thank you. How would you recommend dealing with people that may create a perception of being extraordinarily receptive, particularly when you're dealing with volunteerism, and the reality is that there's clearly resistance? You don't want to seem needy, and at the same time, you want to be able to offer up as much as possible. So when there's clearly some resistance... regardless of what you're confronted with, again, because it's volunteer and it's sort of the way
right.
the community is involved,
right.
How would you recommend dealing with that?
What's your name, by the way?
Daniel.
Dave. Does anybody
Daniel.
Have any...
Sorry.
I'm sorry. Dan.
Okay,
Dan. It's kind of hard to hear up here. It kind of like vibrates, huh? Does anybody have any suggestions for Dan or any ideas for him? He's back in that table.
I think she's right on the mark in terms of relationships. What I suggest is a way to think about what's the foundation of a relationship that you want to ask, make requests into, that it would be based on an appeal that you make to these people who are volunteering, where they commit to getting more value out of the opportunities to the user groups and they're putting energy into it. They've got to commit to that without that incremental relationship.
How people are on the other side as a member having to approach leadership? Say, okay, this is here's some things that we're willing to commit this time to, we're willing to contribute. And yet, although you get a clear facade of people are very receptive, there's clear resistance. The old guard.
I think very, very clear that we could probably talk about this for a while. I think there's a couple areas to start with is get to the root of the resistance. Something that I also really like to suggest to people is, you know, you flip it, right? So once you understand what the resistance is, you know, then ask them. All right, so it's a leadership style of kind of that, you know, human asset thing. It's like, okay, you know, we've identified here's the resistance. How do you think we should handle it? Give up that control. Let them figure it out because either they're going to come up with a great way or they're going to realize that, oh, wait a minute, this isn't right. And then you can then start asking them to commit to something else because clearly the thing you need them to commit to, they're not committing to. So you got to kind of, you know, deconstruct what the resistance is and then try to put it back together with a new commitment would be kind of a great place to start. So I know we're getting very close on time. And I just kind of want to kind of finish up here. One of the great ways to identify your own style and your own belief systems is to choose a few people that you admire out in the world. And again, they don't have to be coworkers. They could be anybody. They can be politicians. They can be athletes, whatever works for you. And ask yourself, why do you admire them? What are the qualities that come to mind? And then pick one of those attributes and just try it for 1 week in your office or at home or with the user groups. And see if you start getting a little bit more of a pace to what you're doing or you start getting a result from it. Because, again, I think we're all very influenced by people that we've either worked for or worked around in the past. And so you can start really identifying what is attractive to you. It helps you identify, you know, are you strategic? Are you human assets? Are you box? What is it that you need to display out there from a leadership perspective? Because people will respond to that. Okay? So if there's any questions, we've got maybe a couple minutes. Where is you guys? Do we have like 5 minutes or where are we on time?
About three minutes.
Okay. So the presentation will be up on the site. I also created a couple of handouts for you all if you're interested. It's how to think like a leader, and it kind of identifies some of these things that we talked about and gives you a chance to kind of assess where your mindset is on this. And then there's another thing that, again, that I use when I help people identify where their leadership skills are at. And I call it leadership essentials. So within that, there are several categories on consistency, passion, foresight, energy, expertise, and the change architect. Those are kind of the main areas that I think really draws great leaders out. And again, you all already possess all of this. It's just a lot of it is getting you to see it so that you can then start using it in what you do every day. So these will also be available for you on the website. Questions? Okay. Did anybody have any questions or comments as we close in the back?
Did you list the book?
I didn't list the book. I apologize. But I do you want to come up afterwards and write it down? Or? Yeah, it's Maximum Leadership. And it's Charles Farkas and Philip DeBacher. It's a really great book on styles. Yeah.
We're all dealing with volunteer organizations. We're looking for the program in many ways.
The core leadership challenge, well. You know, I would have to say that, you know, people want to belong to stuff, and then when they find out what it is, it's hard to keep them with it. So I do think there's some motivation. I think a lot of people come to volunteers because they want to learn. So finding that way for them to connect and finding a way for them to be a stakeholder. You know, I work with a volunteer group, and everybody on the staff is volunteer, and if they do not have a specific role, they can't be in. So part of what we do with them, and it sounds kind of harsh, but we're short on time, so I'll kind of try to keep it clipped, but it's that concept of everybody needs to have a stake in the outcome, and they have to be willing to do that. So there has to be a certain set of ground rules that are immovable, and then everything else can kind of flow around it. People want to belong to something. They've got to find a way to connect and keeping them motivated. And again, getting some of the under-motivated people to drive that for you so you don't have to do all the work, that's a really big key for everything. We think we have to do all the work, and we don't. Part of our job is to get other people to step up and do it, because again, once you're in it, it's much harder to throw stones at it. Yes?
You mentioned that as far as leadership is concerned, that for some companies, it's best that leadership is something that comes from the center, not from perhaps the top, like a hierarchical system. Did you believe that for specific types of organizations, or is it a general rule for everybody that is a nonprofit or a corporation, yeah, or a small business?
You know, I tend to think that all organizations have to have some kind of culture, right? So it may not necessarily be the person, But there's got to be, the culture's got to be at the center. So whether it's a nonprofit or whether it's, you know, a corporation, the culture's got to be at the center so that people are actually feeding, you know, feeding into it and feeding out of it. And so it's a little bit of a, you know, chicken and egg thing, if you will.
I think it's a really good philosophy, and that's what my mom asked the question. I think that is important too. Is there looking at something above you?
Yeah.
Or something you're working for? Is something you're working with?
Mm-hmm.
More partner asking, less parent child, I guess?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Philosophy in general, I think it's in general.
Yeah, I think so much of what we have seen, and that's part of why I got into this, is because I think there's a better way out there. Companies have done the acquisitions and the mergers, they've done the reorgs, and they're still in the same situation. So what it tells me is there's a better way out there, and to me, it's about people. And again, you've got to have the vision there, and the culture's got to be there, and then there has to be the right people. People will choose to participate or not. You don't have to force people to do things because, you know, 99% of us want to contribute. We want to be somewhere where we're going to, you know, our presence is going to be felt. Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope you all enjoy the rest of the conference. And again, thank you so much for letting me speak with you. It was really nice.